You know, there are many people who have very good ideas. The only thing they need is money. And frankly, that group, you know, of people who are innovating, if they got, all you need to do is give them money and they'll succeed. That's fine. But that is not typical to the DARPA process. Almost all of the projects that I'm aware of that were successful are really creating interfaces and relationships between very disparate groups that don't often want to work together.
Thanks for listening to Sprint, the podcast of the Federal Agency for Disruptive Innovation. In this podcast, we talk to people who think in new ways in order how to bring the new into the world. I'm the host. My name is Thomas Ramge, and I'm delighted to have our first English-speaking guest today on our show. He is the Director of Innovative Technology Solutions at the Gates Foundation. And before that, he has been a program manager at the legendary DARPA Innovation Agency of the U.S. military. His name is Dan Wettendorf, and I'm very pleased to welcome you from California. Thanks for chiming in.
Thank you.
Hey, Dan. Dan, why did you choose to become a microbiologist or a geneticist or than even an innovation manager?
Well, I started a very traditional way, like many others, wanting to be a physician. Of course, one of the challenges I find of medicine in the U.S., colloquial terms, they call it the practice of medicine, because we often are using heuristics and not always have the ability to use first principles to understand root causes of disease. And so what was appealing about genetics is you get to very specifically the root cause of a disease, and you, by understanding the A, C, T's, and G's in the genome, you can see any time that they are misspelled or being used in a different way, that is a potential opportunity for either correcting those deficits or, as in the case that we may discuss later, you have the opportunity to create new therapeutic opportunities. And so that was certainly very appealing to me and led to a career training for that purpose clinically, early years at NIH under the current director of NIH, Francis Collins. And then over the years, not only using, you know, genetics to be able to care for patients, but actually to create new therapeutic tools.
You started off as a military doctor. Probably most of us will first think, when thinking about military doctors, of surgeons treating soldiers. What was your role in the military?
Well, in the U.S., there is an opportunity to have college paid for if you join the military. And so I was in an Air Force ROTC program at Cornell University, and that was able to pay for my college, and then after that, medical school. And of course, after that, the residencies and fellowships that led to both clinical and laboratory genetics at the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. Much of my time was spent working at NIH, even though I was in the military. But certainly, you know, the military needs, you know, the full breadth of technical capabilities, and indeed, just like a very large single-payer healthcare system like the German healthcare system, you know, the military in the U.S. is a microcosm of that, and so needs all of those disciplines. But I believe the type of geneticist I was, there was only one or two of, you know, so it was a pretty unusual specialty.
Transferring from the military into the DARPA, which is obviously a military-funded innovation agency, sounds like a very logical step in your career, was it?
I would say, actually, no, it was a little bit surprising. I mean, to be quite honest with you, the National Institutes of Health is in Bethesda, Maryland, right out of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and I was there seeing patients, working in laboratories, things that I think most people would, you know, understand in terms of if you're in the biomedical science realm and a clinician. But as you mentioned, the military did come into this factor of why I ended up at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And that was because even though I was a human geneticist and mostly caring for people who had cancer genetics or other types of inherited disorders, the military's need at that time was to be able to understand whether an infectious disease, particularly an emergent one, that developed somewhere outside the world could be identified, a diagnostic capability. And some of the technologies that the military engineers were funding were biotechnologies that were of measurement of health. And those companies were frankly having some trouble getting U.S. through U.S. regulatory because we needed those diagnostic devices to be FDA approved and brought anywhere in the world. And I was a lab director. And so there was a desire that I got involved in those projects, essentially funding science, something I had not intended to do, and was really something that was asked for me to get involved in. And then once I did that, of course, that led to many other relationships, which introduced me to some people who worked at this agency that I was pretty unfamiliar with. And some of those projects became successful. And then there was a ask that I go work with them. That really actually wasn't my intention, but it was a great opportunity, frankly, for me to be able to stay in the DC area, be able to continue to practice clinical medicine and work at NIH. And then I, of course, my life shifted quite dramatically once I began that odyssey.
Why is that? How did it change then?
Well, you know, I was spending all of my time seeing patients and working in human genetics. And what I thought would just originally, you know, initially just be a few hours a week and helping infectious disease research funding, that became more and more involved and started to occupy more and more of my time. By the time I got to DARPA, I was spending 4 out of 5 days a week with DARPA and 1 day a week at NIH seeing patients. And, you know, that really became quite a catalytic moment in my life because I did realize the transformative opportunity that was allowed at that agency. And I think there's still quite a bit of confusion about how that agency works. It's just one rented building in Arlington with, you know, a couple of hundred people who are federal government employees. By the way, very, very few of them actually are in the military. Almost all of them come from civilian backgrounds, from the private sector, from industry, from universities. I was probably one of a handful of people that happened to be actually in the military while I was there.
And you seem to have looked into a research topic that was very relevant to the military, viral threats at the time, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, in some ways, it's not that surprising when a lot of it comes again from this lineage of the circumstances of my career. While I was at NIH, I was on what's called an institutional review board for gene therapy. And that institutional review board, like across the globe, assesses the ethics of clinical research. And in that setting, we were reviewing the Jesse Gelsinger case at the time, where there was a death at the University of Pennsylvania from a gene therapy approach using a viral vector, an adenoviral vector. And part of that stuck with me because anytime you put any viral proteins into a human being to deliver a gene, there is always this question of whether that will lead to an inflammatory response, which indeed went awry in the case with Jesse Gelsinger. And so it put in my mind both the associated risks of certain types of research and, you know, certain opportunities that would mitigate against those risks that would be inherently safe. And of course, that was RNA. And RNA delivered without putting it in a viral coat, but putting it in a delivery system that, while it may cause your arm to be sore, is unlikely to cause any of those types of safety issues that can occur with some of the viral vectors.
What year are we talking? When was that?
I went to DARPA in 2010.
Okay. So RNA studies had been done for about 10 years or had been more intensely done for 10 years. What was sort of the state of the technology? Where did you start on? And how did you take this technology in order to use it for your project?
Right. So I think since the time of Rosalind Franklin and Francis and Crick, many people dreamed that you could use the structure of the DNA molecule to make proteins of interest. And the recombinant DNA revolution in the 1970s, first, that you could precisely cut based on the genetic sequence, a very specific spot in the genome. And then later, that you could make a protein of interest, human insulin and others, outside the body, started to take off. And the whole biologics revolution and Genentech and Herb Boyer, that really accelerated in the 1980s. So now we could create proteins that were human in non-human hosts like yeast or bacteria or, frankly, Chinese hamster ovary cells, where most of antibodies that are human antibodies that are made for clinical purposes are. So the idea of taking a piece of a gene and making a protein of interest was not a new one. In fact, for vaccines, people had tried that with DNA. In fact, many of the major biopharmaceutical companies had. But there were problems because when they tried to do that, of course, you need to deliver that genetic element into a cell. And if you're going to deliver it into a living person, you need to disrupt the lipid bilayer that is around all of our cells. And you could do that physically, or you could do that with a virus, because viruses have evolved to do that. Or you could do it with some other material component that you would put the DNA in. And of course, those who cared about vaccines figured DNA would make a good vaccine, because from the time, of 200 years of vaccinology, first we used live bugs, then dead bugs, and then just understanding the specific protein that was on the surface of a bug that elicits the appropriate immune response, we went on this path of ever safer and ever smaller components of the organism, the bug, that to be able to train the immune response as a vaccine. Of course, instead of adding the bug, live or dead, or the protein that is on the surface, you could make the protein with DNA if you could get it into the cell. And the DNA vaccine community failed to show strong immune responses. And there were some questions of why that was, but a lot of people felt like that there was not enough protein made. And understanding a little bit about genetics as a geneticist, it seemed that RNA had a couple of opportunities that DNA did not. And RNA, in its structure, embedded in its structure of the RNA molecule, because it has a three-dimensional structure, it connects or it gets sensed by the immune system of the cell, and you can control, you can tune that immune system so that certain immune signals are turned on that are helpful for vaccine, and certain immune systems, immune sensors in the cell are turned off. And so by understanding the structure, understanding the chemistry, and that's where the uridine gets very technical, but some of the modifications that cells make on RNA naturally, viruses do not. And that allows your body to sense whether it's your own RNA or a foreign RNA that comes from a virus. those type of understanding helped provide the opportunity that you could design RNA in a way that not only makes the protein, but tunes the immune response. And any vaccine, you need two things. You need the structure to train the immune system like a puzzle piece, but you also need to appropriately tune the immune response with a danger signal. Without the danger signal, you don't generate an immune response. In a natural infection, viruses duplicate. They copy themselves. And that copying process, the structure of the RNA, and the chemical modification of the RNA, the body is sensing as danger. So you need to incorporate the danger. You need to incorporate the structure. And in 2010, it seemed like there was enough understanding that we could rationally do that if only we could deliver the RNA inside a cell.
Well, if I understand right, your role at DARPA had been at that point to speed up that process of technology innovation. Since we know now a lot about the inner workings of the cell in the context of vaccines, what were the inner workings of your research group or the organization in order to speed up that technology development?
Right. So I think the difference, of course, science and technology is an ever-evolving condition in many fields going on all the time. I think what is different, again, about this agency and their method is that it is directed and not directed by an advisory board, not directed by a governance board, not directed by a predetermined strategy, but directed by a single individual with a deep passion to reach the objective. And I think that is very differentiating. In most places that I have been involved with, it is the governance structure and essentially the corporate structure, the organizational structure, and the strategy of the group that's guiding the project. At DARPA, it is the individual. And it is not that individual is necessarily doing the science. There is no internal labs at DARPA.
Yeah, right. You're an innovation manager. That's the role, right? You manage the innovation process.
Given as much authority as possible within the constraints of the U.S. law. You know, it's said many times on the internet and many times in many circles, you know, why did DARPA even come to exist? And, you know, frankly, post World War II, during the time of the development of space technology, at that time, the U.S. did have quite a bit of capital. You know, it was a world power in terms of capital opportunity. And so it wasn't capital limited in terms of being able to fund, you know, trying to get to space. And the technology was there. The Army had the rocketry lift from Wernher von Braun. The Navy had the avionics pointing, you know, how to point the rocket to the right direction. But the bureaucracy in the United States military, who the U.S. president, in this case, it was Eisenhower, who was a logistician, realized that, you know, logistics and bureaucracy have many, many important purposes and do many things well. But moving with alacrity, moving with speed, when you have a defined objective, is not always the time that you need to use the group. And the Army and the Navy bureaucracy was fighting inside the Pentagon incessantly. And Eisenhower felt like that was what led to the Soviet Union having the advance to be able to put Sputnik in space first. So for some technical innovations, to really reach the goal with speed, there is an opportunity to take one person and allow them to make the decisions that are normally made by multiple groups and committees.
How did you feel this freedom of decision making in your role? Could you just run around and write huge checks to scientists that seemed interesting or talented to you, or how did that work?
Unfortunately, it isn't of course that easy. But let me walk you through what I saw when I was asked to go there. You know, I told you I had been working in NIH and seeing patients, following gene therapy, following the clinical trials of gene therapy, and understanding essentially how to put a genetic element into a cell to make a protein. And I was asked to go present how would we deal with a particular threat. DARPA has a wide mission space of protecting the nations, or even, frankly, global security. Of course, my background is biology, so biosecurity would be the obvious thing that I would go speak about. And when I walk into that building, you can imagine, based on what I've said, that it wasn't that significant of a leap of creativity to speak about how we could, you know, potentially make vaccines or drugs with genetic elements by understanding the tools of gene therapy, which I did. And of course, talked to them about this opportunity of using RNA for vaccine.
Sure, but how did you use that freedom? How do you use the freedom you were describing that had been deeply rooted in that very special organization?
Well, so this is actually where I was kind of leading to. You walk in, so you get the job, and then you show up at work like you show up at work anywhere else in the world. You know, you get a badge. In this case, the badge, they take a picture of you and they put in very bold font the date that you're leaving, which is usually 2 years after you arrive. So you feel this tremendous urgency. And they tell you, you still have to use fair and open competition rules, which means you have to put a solicitation out to the general public that people can apply for this grand, you know, aspirational capability that you want to create. We want to be able to create vaccines rapidly without ever growing bugs outside the body. And we want to not only make these RNA vaccines to be, we want to be able to tune them to the immune system. And those solicitations, for example, are still on the web. So I had to publish those. But after you get that badge, you walk into a room, which is your office, very, very typical office. And you have an assistant that helps you with some of the administrative functions like you would do in most jobs of the world. And you are to come up with a structure to define how you're going to get there by identifying these communities, and you need to put out that solicitation. So to your very, you know, pointed question, are you walking around throwing around Mad Money? No, because you have to convince entities to actually apply to this open solicitation that does come with encumbrances. It's not, you know, first of all, people have to write the application, which can be onerous to a government proposal. They have to have an accounting system that the government can manage. And then there are certain stipulations that come with those contracts or grants. And those include, you know, the ability to have march-in rights, for example, which, you know, could have been enacted, frankly, you know, in this situation. Because as we're about to discuss, I ended up funding companies that were not in the United States. And those companies were very likely going to manufacture their product offshore, not necessarily onshore in the U.S. And so those become challenging, you know, to interface both large companies, the biggest pharmaceutical companies, emerging biotechs like the ones that were arising in Germany, and then individual academics. And then finally, and that's just the last key piece, knitting those people together is very, very difficult to do and truly requires a lot of, you know, a personal fortitude. Because you are alone trying to get different academics and different biotechnology companies and then large pharmaceutical companies to work together. And that is the secret, I would say, is that personal management across these disciplines. You know, there are many people who have very good ideas that the only thing they need is money. And frankly, that group, you know, of people who are innovating, if they got all you need to do is give them money and they'll succeed, that's fine. But that is not typical to the DARPA process. Almost all of the projects that I'm aware of that were successful are really creating interfaces and relationships between very disparate groups that don't often want to work together.
Huh. Can you force them to collaborate?
No, of course.
To be more open, to share information, to, I don't know, help each other out, and to an extent that they're not used to and that might even contradict to their personal interests?
Yeah. So you can, again, you're still operating within the rules of the federal government, the law. I'm sure that's probably true in Germany in terms of what is, you know, termed as teaming. You absolutely cannot force teaming. And so I guess this becomes the art of the project, is that you do have your voice. And frankly, the voice at DARPA is fairly strong because of its reputation. So walking into that building, you are cloaked with that advantage that, frankly, people know that if you're coming from DARPA and encouraging people to work together in a very discreet, defined way, they're more likely to do so because of the reputation of the agency. Of course, you have money, and that money, in some ways, they know that you can make a decision versus, let's say, funding at the National Institutes of Health, where the decisions are made by peer review, a group of scientific peers who are reviewing your proposal blind. At DARPA, your reviews are handled in a much smaller way, and the program manager has much greater authority to make decisions. And so the people who are proposing know that. And so because they know that you have the ability to make funding decisions quickly, and they know the reputation of the organization, they're more likely to work together. But in fact, I would say people are people and organizations are organizations. And part of the requirement for success is finding program managers who have, bluntly, the personal aptitude, the personal strength of will to get these groups to work together. And frankly, that is both exhausting and exhilarating and a major component of the role.
How did you pick those people? Like a football manager who from the very beginning looks at, okay, he's great talent, but he's not a good team player, so I won't pick him?
No, I think it starts with first principles of the technical problem. So there are some things, as I mentioned, you heard me describing how a vaccine could work and what we knew and what we didn't know. As I mentioned, I did not want to use a virus to deliver this genetic element, DNA or RNA. But we could use a physical force like electricity, or you could use something else. Lipids would be one of them. And I knew that to achieve a vaccine, of course, you need to get the material that you want from outside of the body, inside of the body, across the cell membrane, into a compartment called the endosome, out of the endosome, and into a replicating body. And when you march through those steps, there were some things we knew how to do and some things we did not. And then begins a odyssey of speaking to people where you have decomposed the problem and understood the most critical challenges, the hardest elements, and you start asking people how they would approach this problem. And I think, you know, one way to reduce risk is to have multiple shots on goal. So we tried to find the most difficult aspects of why this couldn't be achieved and fund several different groups who really had orthogonal or different approaches to that solution and make very discrete milestones for experiments to see if they can solve that. And that becomes how you compose the problem. It is also how you gate or determine whether groups continue. And again, I think this is another key secret, which is very difficult. Very easy to say, very difficult to do, which is once you've made these funding decisions, you start pruning, you start editing, you start, you know, pulling the weeds. Very easy to throw seeds on the ground and very easy to nurture your garden, but very few people want to pick the weeds, and even fewer want to pick the, you know, the plants that are not the most successful, because they, you kind of fall in love with your babies, right? And nobody wants to do that. And so that culling of the research and the development work that is not the most ambitious and or not most likely to be successful requires a lot of quite a lot of challenges. So, you know, that I would say that was a, another major component of the success of the projects.
And how did you, in that case, overcome the hurdles?
Well, I don't have an answer to that other than you select program managers that have the strength of will to do that.
Okay. It's all a question of willing.
Yeah, I think it's all a question of will.
Aim high, reach high, and you have the personal strength, and then you manage it. Oh, well, that's quite a secret sauce, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, again, I don't know in Germany, but I can tell you at the U.S. NIH, our grants at the NIH are called R01. The typical one is called an R01. They are never canceled. You know, that you give investigators 5 years to work on a research problem. They publish their research, you know, and it's generalizable knowledge to the world. And frankly, it's a very good thing. I'm very supportive of that model. But nowhere in that model is anywhere going to any of those investigators who compose their research problems and evaluating their performance during that 5 years and saying, well, this guy over here seems to be doing much better. And this woman over here, she seems to be actually got an even more ambitious idea. So we're going to take your money and we're going to go ahead and fund her. And that constant active management, managing the spreadsheet, frankly, you know, the playing the German board game where you are constantly making decisions for optimization with your pieces on the game, that is a must. And that is what allows you to move ahead quickly versus putting the pieces into play and letting them play out.
You were mentioning this legendary reputation of DARPA stemming from these huge disruptive innovation successes it had in the past. And I mean, probably the most prominent example is the internet, the TCP/IP protocol, and the founding of what is the internet and the World Wide Web today. How does it feel to work in an organization that has that reputation and which is often sort of described as, when I think a former director of yours said, an agency or a travel agency connecting 100 geniuses?
It is an incredible culture that allows that risk, that cultivates that risk. It is certainly kinetic. It is that you feel every day going there, you know, the term in the U.S. is like your hair is on fire with an incredible sense of urgency, because as I mentioned, you're wearing a badge that shows that you're leaving in 2 years, and it takes quite a bit of time. You know, as I was trying to refer to, you walk in there with that office and the administrator, you have no money, you have no team. You have to make the case to the director of the agency to get resources. Once that is successful, then you essentially have a bank account. And yes, you have some travel. Frankly, I don't believe the travel was unlimited. You're traveling on government, you know, in the back of a plane. You're not traveling business class. But the urgency and the necessity to, as I said, to essentially not only try to pick winners, but to cull losers as fast as you can is so part of the culture that it transforms you almost instantly. I think it would be hubris, or, you know, I was not a DARPA program manager before I went to DARPA. You know, what I brought was, you know, my personality and my content. And that organization, frankly, shaped how I approached problems. And so I do think there is a culture there that is very hard to mimic just by prescribing a set of rules. And that culture, I have not seen many other places.
I think you stayed finally 5 or 6 years, right?
Yeah, 6 years.
6 years. What kind of then walked out of the door? How this man had changed from the man walking in first time 6 years before?
Well, you certainly learn, you know, I think it's human relationships and the navigating fame, power, and money is certainly something that I felt much more comfortable with after going to that agency and walking out than when I did walking in. I also think, you know, it can create challenges. Frankly, a lot of DARPA program managers, after they go to their next job, they don't stay that long because it can be very disorienting working back in an organization. At the Gates Foundation, there is an African proverb on one of the walls that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I always smile walking past that because, of course, everyone is, you know, likes this proverb. Going together is, you know, how you go far. And I don't disagree with that. You need that for scaling almost anything. And we're always working with groups. But that proverb is equal on both sides. If you want to go fast, though, sometimes you do need to go alone. And we often have scouts in the world that are really finding the new frontiers. You don't want to take the entire group when you're going to scout something and set something up. You need some people doing that. And often I think we are trying to do everything with the collective group. And that is not always the easiest way to reach some of these goals.
Do you think humanity has become better in walking fast, producing disruptive innovations like a coronavirus vaccine?
Yes. I mean, I think the connectedness of the world that we're using, you know, the technology we're using now. In fact, I think a lot of this can evolve again. It's interesting to me that, you know, I have, like many people, been children that are in college, and it seems kind of absurd now that they go to one geographical location and then they pick professors and classes that are in that geographical location. But, you know, when I think about funding all of these projects, the people who had the competencies to work on RNA vaccines are embedded throughout the world. And we just need to connect those people, not ad hoc, but by design for a period of time, and frankly, disconnect them so that they can go work in their own spaces and then reform them and connect them to work on the next step of the project. I think, you know, education, why would we even have students in universities, you know, work with one collective set of professors in one place? Frankly, if you were interested in a certain field of chemistry, why shouldn't you take your classes with 15 professors in that specialty across the world? And if you have a specific project on that and you want to work across disciplines, why couldn't you connect with other people? I think our ability to make those connections now because of, you know, the internet and because of mobile technologies, because of the storage and retrieval of information is so facile. I think technology development should be much easier. So from the tool set we have, they're better than ever. But I also think the human component, we haven't evolved that much. We're still the same organisms that were designed, you know, by nature, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago and eons ago. We're still highly tribal, and we still have all of the encumbrances of being a human, and all of our ego and our relationships are perturbed by that. And so it is that component of working with people that both you know, composing people in the right way for these types of solutions is so critical and still requires people, and technology has not solved that.
This all sounds a lot to me, what he's saying, as if it could be condensed in the term co-opetition, basically being very collaborative at the one side and at the same time very competitive. Is that hitting the nail?
It absolutely is. And knowing the difference, when do you need which one, and being purposeful about it versus letting those be? Those are emergent phenomenon in both cases. I think if you take any group of people, children at a playground, you'll see those children in an emergent phenomenon play together cooperatively and play together competitively. And, you know, what happens is what happens. But if you really are trying to drive towards a goal, if you're being very rational and specific about where you, the objective you're trying to get to, I think it is a very astute point that you make, that choosing when you want competition and choosing when you want collaboration and cooperation and knowing the difference is very, very important. And you're constantly tuning that.
So we found the secret sauce for disruptive innovation, finally.
Well, I think that's one of many.
One component. Yeah, and it's always hard to find the mix. Let me ask the last question, which I ask to every of our guests here, is if you could wish for a radical, disruptive, world-changing innovation for the year, say, 2050. It doesn't have to be in your field of expertise. It could be anything. What would you wish for?
Oh.
Just one. I know you have a lot. Now you're trying to pick. Now you're trying to pick between several, I'm sure. Just this, the most exciting one.
I think it would be the first 5 years of life that there would be, we would really understand learning, neurocognitive learning, how a human brain is able to take in information and be ready for the world. I don't know that we have really understood that, again, back at a first principles level, language, executive motor function, all of those type of cognitive capabilities that make us, different from the animal species, and make that accessible universally, so that, early childhood education was a common ground for humanity, and that it was optimized for the brain in a way that is built on fundamentals of neuroscience.
And what would this understanding or complete understanding of that phase in our life lead to? What would we gain?
I think, the beauty of humanity is the diversity. It's built on the comments you had mentioned a moment ago between cooperativity and competition. I think, the world can be an incredibly diverse place, and we want to cultivate that diversity. But I think education, and particularly early childhood education, ensuring each child has that opportunity to be connected cooperatively in the world, is really dependent on getting a good intellectual start. And I'm not sure that we have optimized. We certainly, there are inequities in the world, but I even think technically we haven't optimized development and education in ways that we could. And if we did, I think there would be a commonality of the human experience that is ready to connect and participate in civil society and cultural development with some shared humanity.
Thanks, Dan, for this incredibly interesting deep dive journey into cells and into the inner workings of an organization which has obviously been one of the role models, possibly the most important one, for the German Federal Agency for Disruptive Innovation.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks a lot, Dan. To you listeners, thanks a lot for your attention. If you like our podcast, we'd be delighted if you could leave a review. And well, in 2 weeks from now, we'll have the next episode. Until then, stay curious, bleib neugierig.